Welcome to the Secrets from the Green Room podcast.
The author stories you won't hear anywhere else.
I'm Emma Gold.
And I'm Craig Cormick.
And we're supported by the ACT Writers Centre and Hilltop Recording Studio.
So come into the Green Room with us and let's see what we uncover.
Okay, Craig, let's talk about writing groups.
Oh, the group thing, yes.
I mean, we've both been part of multiple writing groups. We've been in writing groups together, which were good ones, but some of them are not so great. What's your experience been?
So, yeah, writing groups are a funny thing because, you know, writing is an isolated process, really, but most writers want to hang out with their tribe at some point, and want to find another group of people who'll tell them how good their book is. You know, basically that's what you join a writing group for, surely. And some people in writing groups don't belong in groups because they don't want criticism of their book. They don't want constructive criticism. They just want to tell how good it is. So over the years, I've been in a couple of groups. Some have formed sort of dynamically, organically, and got together and just grew and stayed together and then slowly reached their shelf life and expired. And others were sort of more constructs. So I invite that person, that one to be a part of my writing group. And I don't know if there's a perfect formula for them. I know sometimes they're great, sometimes they're not. Sometimes the people, they're really gel. Sometimes they grate on each other. But it's like we're human beings. That's inevitable. It's going to happen.
Yeah, I had a writing group that I was in I had a few bad experiences in, namely one where one of the other writers in the group, when it came turn to analyse my short story, tossed it across the table and said, "I don't want to read anything this negative." Wasn't even that negative, which is really unhelpful. But I've had other writers' groups which have just been amazing, and we were in one that was a short story one, which I actually started after having that bad experience. I thought, I am going to pick a bunch of writers who I know are all kind of like-minded, can all give criticism and take criticism, which for me is the point. Like, I'm not interested in somebody just saying, this is great. I actually am there to improve my writing. And Those were fantastic, both in terms of the work itself, but I would always come away buzzing from those sessions. Like, I couldn't sleep afterwards because you just got all these ideas. So we would talk about each other's work, and then we would often move on to talking about just general writing-related stuff, which I think is also useful. And there's that sense of community and, you know, it's actually, because writing is so solitary, it's so important. I know some people who go away on retreats with their writing groups, which seems to work really well. But I always think one of the dangers of writing groups when it's a bunch of new and unpublished authors is that all of those people are not terribly experienced and yet are giving feedback, which may or may not actually be helpful.
Yeah, I have had colleagues come and say, look, I'm in a writing group and I'm perplexed because I put my novel piece or short story in the group and they commented and got all these differing opinions. So what should I go? Who should I go with? Or should I try and meet them all? I think some of that comes from, people starting out the journey. They might have different opinions. Or often it's, this is what I would do if I was writing your manuscript.
Yeah.
Rather than, this is what you need to do to improve your manuscript. And there's a big difference in those, but I don't think everybody always sees it.
No, and that's where, I guess, with experience, you learn to recognise what advice you want to take on and what you want to reject. But it does make a difference who that group of writers actually is and how experienced they are.
Well, I gave a recent manuscript to a colleague we both know very well, who I won't name here today, because I knew he would hate it. It would piss him off so much, this manuscript. But I thought, that's what I want to get. I want to give it to someone who's going to love it. I want to give it to someone who's going to drive him crazy. But in doing that, his comments are going to be so focused. And I'll be able to take them away and really work around those to polish it into something quite good.
So did you find it useful, the response?
I expected the response and it did. He said, this book tricked me. How dare you trick me with this book? I was going along the story halfway and then you pull the rug out from under my feet. Rah! And I thought, yeah, I was expecting that. And so it was very interesting to me to see how that worked and how that changed the way he read the manuscript. And there was a couple of things I was able to fine tune very good. And I said, did you pick up that? You didn't pick up the clues I dropped. Huh. So I had to go back and say, okay, those clues need to be a little bit more subtle.
Yeah.
Or less subtle, make it a bit more obvious.
Yeah. I mean, when you get a person or a writer's group that gives you that kind of feedback, it's just invaluable, isn't it?
It is. And look, I used to teach at university years ago and I used to tell the tutorials often undergraduates, and I say, look, you come in here, you treat the tutorial like, yeah, I can come but I don't come. You'll never in your life be at another stage where you have writers all at the same stage of development, all like this, sharing work with each other and learning how to comment on each other's stuff. You'll finish your degree and go out and you'll think, damn it, I didn't realise how valuable that was. I just took it for granted. Because, you know, writing groups are smaller. After all, you know each other. You've got to be careful not compromising. You've got egos to contend with. You've got friendships to contend with. And, you know, it can be a challenge.
But it's true. I do know some people who have lost friendships through writers' groups where somebody's given feedback and it has just not sat well with the other person to the point where that friendship is actually dissolved.
And, you know, my basic advice always is never ask friends or family for comment for that exact reason. Because either they'll soften it so much because they like you so much, they don't want to say anything negative, or they'll say something really negative, they don't get it or something's wrong, and it puts something into the relationship that you don't want.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Sophie Laguna is the author of 21 books for children and adults. Her books for young people have been named Honour Books and Notable Books in the Children's Book Council of Australia Book of the Year Awards and have been shortlisted in the Queensland Premier's Awards. Her first novel for adults, One Foot Wrong, was longlisted for the Miles Franklin Award and shortlisted for the Prime Minister's Literary Award. And her second novel, The Eye of the Sheep, was shortlisted for the Stella Prize and won the Miles Franklin Award. Her third novel, The Choke, won the 2018 Indie Awards and was shortlisted for a number of others. And her fourth and latest novel for adults is Infinite Splendours. Sophie, it is such a pleasure to be here with you. We're at the Headland Writers Festival at the moment in Tarthra, where we're both appearing. We're recording this in a little motel room. But this is a particular thrill for me because I am a massive fan of your work. So I'm going to try very hard not to fangirl. The Eye of the Sheep and The Choke are like two of my all-time favourite books, and I have given them to more people than I can count. And when they were published, was recommending them to everyone. And your latest, Infinite Splendours, just really destroyed me in the way that kind of incredible literature can. And I'm still thinking about those characters. So welcome to Secrets in the Green Room. I can't wait to talk to you about writing.
Thank you. What a fantastic introduction. Thank you, Irma.
So let's just say you started out as a children's author, but then, you know, in more recent years, you've moved into also writing for adults, and you've got four novels for adults, all brilliant novels. Did that feel like a natural shift for you? How did that happen?
It didn't really feel like a shift at all. Oh, is that true? Well, it's true to say it was natural. I was writing One Foot Wrong in between writing children's books. So thinking back, was I aware of a shift as far as the readership goes? Not particularly. I was aware that One Foot Wrong was very uncompromising and it was a very free, very liberated, very idiosyncratic way to write, I suppose. But no, it's other people that are more aware of the shift between writing for children and adults than I am, I think. There's shifts between characters and shifts between plots, but the readership, you know, is largely decided by marketplace, and that's something else. Yeah.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Does it?
Also, because I've written kids' books and I write for adults as well, and it does make a lot of sense that people see things as shifts.
Yeah.
They don't necessarily feel like that to you.
Yeah, I mean, everything is a shift. You know, every character is a shift and every new book is a different movement. But the writing is coming from the same place, and it's certainly the shift is not decided by who the readership will be, because the part of me that writes is not preoccupied with who the readership is going to be or the reader, in fact, at all at the time of creation.
Yeah, which is a really common thing, that you're not actually thinking about that reader as you're writing that first draft.
No, in fact, I need them out, completely out of the way. I need to imagine that it will never be read. Even though that's sort of contradictory, it's so safe.
Yeah,
imagine the freedom. Yeah, imagine the freedom. No one will ever read this. You are free to be how you need to be. This is completely safe. That's a beautiful thing. So I that's different, isn't it? To a lot of other writers are very aware of readers' needs or something. They speak about it sometimes that way.
Yeah, and it's not for me either.
Yeah.
You know, I think I start to think more about the reader when I'm going through the editing process, but writing that first draft, I'm not thinking about the reader at all. And I think, like you, it would be really inhibiting for me to think about the reader at that stage.
It would, wouldn't it?
Yeah, because you're really just with your characters.
You really are.
With your characters.
You really are.
So your characters, they're some of the most vivid that I've read, and I adore them, and they stay with me. And I feel like they're real people whose lives I've briefly been allowed into. Mm. And I have to say, with Infinite Splendors, I actually stopped reading that book and put it aside for a few months because I found that I adored that young boy, Lawrence, so much.
Mm.
And I was finding it really hard bearing witness to the abuse that was happening to him.
Mm.
And then, of course, I came back and I later picked it up and finished the book, which I'm really glad that I did. It's a hard book, but it's a beautiful book. And, you know, like with all of your books, the characters are just so alive. So how do you go about creating your characters? Do you at the beginning instinctively know who they are or do they develop as you start writing?
Both. Both. There must be something that I'll know in the very first pages. They'll be the sort of top. I mean, trying to pin this down to any kind of process is, you know, difficult to find the words for it. I'll begin. There must be seeds of some kind of truth in those early pages, and then pretty quickly I will know their essence, if not immediately, actually, thinking now back over other characters. That essence will be known quickly, and then they will deepen and become whole. As the days go by, as sentence by sentence, they will become much more whole. But there is something in the essence that will be there almost from the beginning, almost very soon anyway.
And by essence, do you mean like an kind of an intrinsic understanding of who they are as a person?
Yeah, like an intuitive knowing of their inner self or something. I've just come up with the word essence because there was nothing else I could think of or hadn't thought of, just an intuitive feel for essentially who they are.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
That invisible essence of self or soul. Or I remember Lawrence in the very first day I encountered him or began him, and he did change. He did change. The very first day he began, I was partially inspired by the Tom Waits song, and I get my Tom Waits songs crossed, but the one about keeping the devil down in the hole, which is a very dark line and a very appealing one to me. Something about, it's kind of primary, isn't it? Something about keeping the devil underground.
Mm.
And that's an idea that I play with in the book. Although, so I might have begun with an idea like that superficially, and very quickly the way I play with that metaphor, both literal and metaphorically, I know I might be hard to follow right now, very quickly Lawrence becomes human. So he's not just an idea. He's not just a prop for an idea, say, about shame or temptation or repression of darkness. Mm-hmm. He becomes whole and real. So he's imbued with my love, I suppose, and my dedication to him. And then what is the real reason why a man needs to go underground? What devil is he keeping in the hole and why? I mean, he's human. So maybe in my view, although I make no sort of strong political stance on this, I must believe that we begin human and whole and wonderful. And something's happened for him to need to go down there. Because, you know, for those of you who haven't heard the story, he needs to take, from the beginning of the novel, I plant the idea that he needs to go and spend time in a bunker in the, on the property.
Yeah, which is...
So it's a long answer, Irma.
It's a great answer. And yeah, that bunker, I mean, gosh, on a both a physical and metaphorical level, it works so amazingly in the book. So I've read, and this kind of follows on from what you were talking about, that you really like writing about transgressions and boundaries.
I didn't know that I did. I wouldn't have any idea.
Well, hopefully that's an accurate quote. And
I know, it would have been. I mean, it must be true because I keep doing it. So
what does that mean to you?
Well, damage happens when boundaries, unspoken boundaries, are crossed. If the person who they happen to happens to be very young or has had very few years yet on Earth, that damage is tenfold and very difficult to unpick and profound and interesting to the writer. And it explains adult complexity, I think. He's a bright guy, the protagonist of Infinite Splendors. He's a bright and sensitive guy, and he thinks deeply, and he's gifted. And every person who... We all suffer trauma and betrayal and transgressions, and we all suffer them differently. And this is how he suffers it. Can't remember where I was going further with that. Yes, so this story is, what is it to have his boundaries crossed? How will it impact on him? What will I make of that, of a life from a transgression that is very serious?
Mm. So do you find, because all of your adult books do deal with trauma and they all have young protagonists. I mean, Lawrence in Infinite Splendors, we also travel through to his adult life, but your other three novels, they all have these young protagonists. Mm. Do you find writing about that trauma challenging?
I don't think I do challenging things. Is that a terrible thing to confess? Challenging things sound really hard. I have to do challenging things all the time. You know, I have to, like, go to parent-teacher meetings, keep it all together. You know, that's hard. Go to the GP. So I wouldn't be doing challenging things as well in my writing.
So it doesn't
hard to convince people.
So being in that space of writing about these difficult things.
Yeah. I don't even think of them as trauma.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
I mean, that all sounds very tedious, really. We hear enough about trauma every time we turn on Radio National or 774, and I listen to a lot of radio. It's only other people who tell me that it's all trauma. I don't even think of it that way for 5 seconds.
Yeah, because you're just thinking about the characters.
Yeah, I just do what I want to do. It's as playful for me. It's playful. I know that, again, it's completely contradictory.
No, it makes sense to me as a writer. Yeah, it does. It does.
I never deliver the answers, it seems, that, you know, to the questions I'm asked.
Yeah, no, it makes sense to me. Yeah. My novel, The Breaking, is set within the tourism industry, and the two characters are rescuing elephants who are abused. And that is obviously something that's challenging to write about. But every day that I wrote those characters in that book, I loved. So I totally understand what you're saying. Yeah, it does. It probably sounds very weird to non-writers, I think.
Yeah, and readers might think I'm... Yeah, it's just very different. I wouldn't be able to do challenging things. I'm always tired, and I just don't feel I could.
So one of the things that you do, I think, really brilliantly in your novels is build the suspense. And, you know, for example, Infinite Splendors, I'm sort of holding my breath half the time going, oh, I can see what's going to happen, and, you know. But you do that really beautifully in all of your books. Is that something that comes naturally to you, or do you have to work
at that? Well, I know. I never knew I was doing it. When you put it to me, I went, that's lucky that I did that, because that's good. But I've got no formula for it. I don't know. I'm glad I did it.
Phew. So it's not like during the editing process you go back and think, oh, you know, the pacing's not quite right here. We need to move forward more so that there's greater suspense.
Yep. No, I won't think greater suspense, but where I might need to give something greater body or more time. Yeah, I'll see where I've failed to work into something. So I might get, you know, write a scene that then will require backstory, or I can see it's hard to explain. I won't be thinking in terms of, oh, got to pull this one out a bit. Not quite as consciously as that around suspense. But I will see where I'm rushing too fast. As I'm getting older, you know, and writing more, I'm better at intuiting, you know, where something will need to be teased out, where it might be asking for a little more.
And then how do you find the editing process?
Enjoyable. I prefer it to the first draft, that's for sure.
Because?
Oh, it's hard. It's hard. It's like, would you rather drive somewhere with a map and a GPS or no map at all? I mean, which is easier? I love the others. I mean, But, I mean, I was speaking with another writer last night. The first draft, you have great spurts of unexpected moments and they're exciting. But then you have to, you know, figure out how you're going to incorporate this character trait, this passion or this love. So you have all a million decisions to be made, and I just desperately want to get to the finish line and have it, have the bones securely down so that I can then play within them very securely and happily. Like, the great unfinishedness is not at all what I like. I don't like it. It's hard. I like to pin it down as soon as I can. I don't like the unknown.
Yeah.
You know?
And are you a pantser? It sounds like you're a pantser. It sounds like you don't plot things out in detail before you start.
Not before I start, but very soon.
Right.
Like, as in the first, soon, yeah. Like, as soon as I'll begin. And as soon as I'll begin, I'll be trying to work it out.
Right.
Yep.
And will you follow that plot once you've got it down, or will you deviate from it?
I won't need to follow it because it'll be as I've decided. I mean, what I mean is it won't be, it will be what wants to happen, will be the intrinsic and right, you know, and I'm trying to find that as soon as I can. So I'm just trying to think back to Infinite Splendors. I would have, even from that first day that I decided on this guy that goes underground, you know, because I first began him in his 50s, I would have been going, what can happen, what can happen, where's he going to go? Okay, so he lives here, he got the bunker, and that will be an occasion. Okay, so if this man goes to a bunker in his 50s, I could introduce the bunker early on. Early on is when the bunker needs to be filled out as a symbol or a metaphor. Yeah, so I'll need to know as soon as I can.
Mm-hmm. So you started life as an actor,
yeah,
which really interests me. That's where your passion originally lay.
It really did.
But what I'd really like to know is how the craft of acting has actually imprinted on your writing or affected the way that you write.
I like the way you put that, imprinted. Mm. I wonder if it has. I mean,
do you think it has?
It's hard to know because it's just who I am. Mm. So you could argue that who I am, you know, took me to acting. I mean, did like, because sometimes I think, gee, I didn't need to do all that acting. I could have just done a writing course and been at peace.
But then an actor inhabits their characters, don't they?
Yeah, but, I mean, did I inhabit my characters? Because that's what comes naturally to me. And so then I ended up acting and suffering for it just because it's a tough, really tough industry.
Yeah.
Or could we say, well, it was full of joy as well. Yeah, maybe more of that. Like, I do have the performer in me, you know, and I'm confident in some ways as a performer, in some ways and not in others. So, but I do know what it is. You know, I did have critical experiences of being immersed in character, and I did learn all sorts of things from going to acting school and from various teachers along the way that I've continued to, what's the word? It sounds ugly to say feed on, but they've continued to teach me. You know, moments that I had in my early 20s have continued to unfold in what they have taught me. And it's hard to pick it all out, isn't it? Because you could argue that, well, the very path I took is what led me here.
Yes.
And exactly. So you could argue that that was exactly the right and necessary path. I was led into acting for children, acting for an audience of children at least, or playing a child. I found that I could play a child with great success. Having said that, no, I remember other roles I played also that I very much loved. And I did learn the ecstasy, but I learned that at 5 of character. I mean, I learned that at 5. I mean, I think, aren't we born knowing that? Isn't that what every kid's doing? That's who we are, I think. Playing different roles and experimenting with character and performance is a part of us. And I suppose it's more interesting or compelling to some than others.
Mm. So now you're a full-time writer,
yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
And that's something many writers dream of who are working jobs and, you know, writing on the side.
Mm-hmm.
Does your reality of that experience fit with what you imagined it might be?
Oh, that's a really interesting question. I never imagined it to be anything else. I've only ever been this way. Mm. I've only ever been, I mean, sure, I've in my acting years worked in pubs and did all sorts of jobs to survive, but I've there's been no, it just feels like it's seamless. I've always been this person surviving on the outside of sort of the mainstream, I suppose. I mean, life as a writer, as soon as I had my first contract offered to me for a picture book, you know, a couple of decades ago, that was it. I never, ever looked back. I then began to tour schools and act out that picture book, My Yellow Blankie, with the props, costumes, everything. And so, you know, once I started doing that, there's been no split between one life really and another. I mean, well,
so you almost never had that experience that a lot of writers have, which is longing for the full-time writing. It's like you almost just segued.
Yeah,
it's
100%. No, that was, I got that, you know, I began My Yellow Blankie, was accepted for publication at some point in the early 2000s or 1999 or something, and all the acting was just went up in a puff of smoke. I was just too busy writing books. And so, yeah, I never longed for, I just have been living it forever, I suppose.
Wonderful. So yeah, do you have a routine that you follow every day?
I've had children, so I was like that, and I would start at the same time. I mean, I'm a creature of habit and routine by nature. I am, absolutely, but children have changed the structure of my writing life for the better.
In what way have they changed it?
Because there's less time, and all that time just did not suit me.
So do you find you're more focused when you have less time?
I was focused, but I had more capacity to beat myself up over, because it's natural to write a novel in 3 hours a day. That's enough. But I would go, you know, at 27 or whatever, but I've got 8 hours. So then I better do it for 8 hours. Isn't that what everyone else is doing? And it was just like horrible. Yeah, so now I've only got 45 minutes. Hooray.
Well, it's obviously working for you, Sophie.
Yeah, it's everything's more rush. I'm working 1,000 times harder than I did get to work in my 20s or my 30s. I'm working so much harder because I'm running a whole other big, you know, domestic life. So definitely wearier at the end of each week. It's more difficult. But I like having limited time is brilliant for creating safe space creatively.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
So you've been longlisted, shortlisted, and won, I mean, pretty much all of Australia's major literary awards. What is your take on literary awards, and which one of those has meant the most to you?
Wow, what a great question. I don't know if I can answer them. who's going to listen to this?
Other writers, you can say whatever you want.
Who's it going out to? Cannot believe you just asked me that question. I might even have to say no comment.
Really?
It's pretty complex.
It is.
It's a complex world.
Yeah. Go on, tell us more.
It's complex. It's political.
Yes.
It's very tricky. It's a tough business. As I, the longer I'm in it, the more I can see, the more aware of that I am. It's pretty ruthless. Is that fair to say?
Yeah.
Without upsetting anyone? It's ruthless. Hmm. It's small. It's a small land with not a lot of space or enough money to support us all.
So when you win one of those awards, how do you feel?
When I won the Miles Franklin, for example, I was numb, unfortunately, and because I had an eight-month-old child to feed all night.
That'll do every it. Night. That'll do it.
All night, every night, every 2 hours.
Yeah.
So it really was survival. I remember talking to a mentor at the time, and I remember she asked me, she spoke to me about the award and how did I feel, and I was so worried at the time about one of my kids. And she said, well, it's good to hear you've got your priorities straight. I didn't even want to mention it. I was so worried about some particular issue, I remember. But I also was very aware that it would be, I approach good news like a suspicious sort of, I circle it like a stray dog. For a long time, it's very difficult for me to just have it. I just circle it and pick over it for a long time, approach it sideways, kick it in the teeth, get cross at it before I'll take it. Does that make sense?
Yes.
It's all complex. Yeah. Writing a book is a creative, safe, dynamic kind of a process that's done in private, that's no expectations. It's just It's just, you know, it's you and your private time in a made-up world that you never intend when you're doing it for anyone else to see. And somehow you've winged it that you've got enough money, at least for the next 6 months, to do it. So I always think in the back of my mind, I could get a job at the pub. But now I'm thinking I couldn't because would they give me a shift? So I guess what I'm saying is I'm also complex about all of these things.
Have you ever won an award and just felt joy?
I can't believe you're asking me these questions. No. When I was a kid, I would stand at the beginning of the running race and go, I am going to win this running race. And then I would run the race and win. I was a fast runner. But you can't do that. Yeah, look, everything outside of the creative process is beyond your control. So, you know, like I heard John Fain actually, he quoted somebody else before he left, and he said, nothing's ever as bad as you think and nothing's ever as good as you think.
So true.
Right? So it's better off being there. It's better off. You can't attach too much to any of those things, and it's all of our greatest challenge. It's a cruel world at times in that way. So
following on from that, yeah. I think that's a great quote.
I don't want people to think I don't experience joy. I'm just difficult.
It's complex.
Yeah.
So how do you approach reviews then? Because, again, like you just said, they can be so amazingly positive.
Yeah.
Or, you know, I don't know if you've had any bad reviews. Yeah. I mean, most writers have had at least one.
Yeah.
How do you navigate that?
It's okay, so before all of this happened, you know, before, say, when I had only written children's books or when there was just One Foot Wrong was shortlisted for the Prime Minister's Literary Award, and I just thought, I didn't even know there was one for a start. So, yeah, that was pretty good. And I remember one of the judges came over to me and she said, look, it's not necessarily, it's very tricky to pick a winner, and it's not necessarily, you know, the best book it wins. And so she was trying to cushion me for the fact that I hadn't won, but she didn't realise, this lovely judge, that I was just so happy. So that's not, so here I am saying I've never experienced something with just joy. Well, I did that time because Philip Adams was there. And I really like Philip Adams, and he was there, and I'd been shortlisted, and I'd never written an adult, and I was longlisted for the Miles Franklin. I'd never written a book for adults before. I was longlisted for the Miles Franklin. Again, that was like, okay, I can really fly. I am going to trust myself. And it's
so that was affirming.
Yeah, it was affirming. Both of those experiences were affirming, and I had nothing else attached to either of them. Honestly, I didn't know. You went long list, short list. I didn't know anything, and how lovely, ignorance is bliss. I was just grateful, and it was published internationally, but it was difficult, yeah, to sell here. So I was okay. I was just, but the further you go along, it is challenging.
So, you know, some writers, or a lot of writers, I think, in one form or another, have a bit of imposter syndrome, and therefore bad reviews, for example.
Oh, but the reviews, yeah. I was getting there, yeah. So back in the day, I wouldn't care if a review was bad. I there is a part of me that is pretty safe in this business, in the creative writing, that won't be silenced, that is quite happy and just is happy to write. But I wasn't fussed about them. I didn't really, again, I just sound naive. It just hadn't hit home to me what they could be or what they were or what they meant. I was just, you know, writing. And then I didn't even know that there was such a thing as only some books get reviewed in the big newspapers and that's really good if you do. And I hadn't all somehow penetrated. And I hope I don't just sound like this is not true, or this is just how I experienced it. Then I learned, of course. I've learned. I've done it now for a lot longer, and I decided, and I've become more sensitive. You know, so now I decided not to read them, because you won't recognise, even good ones won't alter how you were when you wrote it. It doesn't alter its what it meant to you, or it doesn't alter its value. So what is it going to mean to me to read one?
So it's like, now that you understand how it sits within the industry. And I think it's actually a common experience yeah. to know all of that stuff. You know, when you start yeah. out as a writer, you don't know that actually only a few books get reviewed.
Yeah, I didn't know anything, yeah.
And I think a lot of people don't.
Yeah.
So understanding that context now has actually given it more weight.
It's more complex now because it's come smaller. Before all this, it was as if there was an enormous world in the clouds that belonged to very successful writers, and I wasn't bothered by it. But when you learn there is no world in the clouds and it's not that big, then it is much trickier.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Yeah. So you have had a lot of success with awards, but you've also had The Eye of the Sheep and One Foot Wrong optioned for movies.
Yeah.
And I read that you've written the screenplay for One Foot Wrong.
Yeah, so you know, again, that's a pretty fraught business, you know, and so that was close to, you know, the money being raised time and time again with really fantastic, what's the way to put it, talented people committed to the project, and yet ultimately it was too tricky to raise the funding. Even though I wrote the screenplay and there was a fabulous director attached and big names and money too hard to raise for One Foot Wrong. Eye of the Sheep is still in you know, still in there, so it's still optioned. The Choke was optioned for a period of time by the Melbourne Theatre Company, then not. They couldn't find the right dramaturg, but now again it's with a new company, but nothing has yet materialised. So I'm still hoping, but again, yeah, it's not something that is on my mind very much. Yeah, because you know, I've met writers of literary fiction whose all of their books have been optioned for a decade, you know, and it's rare. It's rare. Sometimes they do. It's not something I'm that invested in. I'm very invested in other things. There's only so much of you that you have, isn't there?
Mm.
Yeah, great. And hopefully one day that will happen.
Mm. Yeah, I think it's something people don't know, actually, that books get optioned. And then more often than not, they don't get made into the film or the TV series or whatever yeah. it might be.
Yeah.
Because there's such huge amounts of money and yeah. it, well, as you said, it's very complex. Yeah. All the people that need to be on board and the amounts of money are yeah. just enormous. Yeah,
it's about money in the end.
Yeah.
And
but you do, when things are optioned, you do get a fee.
You do.
So, you know.
A small fee. You'll get a small fee. But often literary fiction is more difficult to realise in film. I mean, so you've got things like Gone Girl, and what there were a whole bunch of those. Mm. Those, you know, I'm giving you an example of a book that was realised in film pretty swiftly, because some of those sorts of stories are. But if it's literary fiction, there's more likely to be much more time inside someone's head, and that's a more difficult feat. And also it's a difficult time to be raising money for something that is more challenging than, say, Gone Girl.
Mm,
yeah. Or the girl. What was it? The other one was The Girl on the Train.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So how did you find writing the screenplay? Was that a team?
No, I wrote alone mostly. Yeah. No, that was came very naturally because I think I do write in pictures.
Mm.
Really, I do. They are very visual books, all of them.
Mm,
so
yeah.
I really literally transposed. It was a great discipline. It was a great exercise, that's what I mean. Because mm. it made you, it was a great, you know, I had to write that screenplay, and then I got the opportunity to edit. I was still doing the final edits for One Foot Wrong, the book. Yeah. And so what that meant was writing the film, it made me be very, very thorough about exactly where everything was and where everybody was and timing, and so then I could apply all that I'd learned to further polish, if you like, the manuscript for the book.
That's so interesting.
Yeah, it was really great to do.
Yeah.
Where is the mantelpiece? How long will it take for the mother to cross the room to get there? When she says she put a clock on, I'm just, you know, throwing it out there, where exactly in the room is it? Everything cleaned up. I mean, any... pass you make on a manuscript, let's say you change the font or change the spacing, that will help you see. Set it out differently, write it as a film, change the voice, you know what I mean? You'll suddenly, it will leap, but print it, speak it out loud, you will hear and see more and more and more and more. And I tell you, it just continues to show you its flaws and weak spots for a long, long, long time.
So we should obviously all write screenplays of our books.
Why not? In the final stage. I mean, all that is just realizing it in pictures. I mean, the story is about what happens. So anything that helps you sharpen the story and get rid of what you don't need is valuable.
Yeah, fascinating. Mm. So shifting gears for a minute here now, what do you think has been the most challenging period of your life as a writer? Looking back on all those years.
Not telling. Not telling.
Can you give us a hint?
No.
Okay. What's been the most exhilarating period then?
Oh, that's nice. Well, my first answer that I want to give you, which is probably not accurate, is writing Infinite Splendors. I mean, I remember the others as exhilarating, but nothing as exhilarating as Lawrence.
Wow.
Yeah, nothing. As Lawrence painting or Lawrence walking on a mountain or Lawrence, he's the most exhilarating because he gave me an opportunity to philosophize, which was great, and to speak about a spiritual sort of a quest. And no, I mean, One Foot Wrong was pretty liberating at moments too. Oh my God, when she uses the axe, that was really liberating. But Lawrence is, it was exhilaration in beauty and bliss. You know, he experienced bliss on the mountain and I loved it. And he quoted those incredibly beautiful letters about, what was that one, Engre, I pronounced that wrongly, the artist, Ingres, spoke about something about this pestiferous world, and Lawrence repeats those words. Just the way he walked to the river and took off his boots and looked at his feet and greeted his feet and his hands, and he fell in love. He fell in love.
What is it that's tiring for you about writing?
Everything that's beyond my control, once that's beyond the writing.
Yeah, so not the writing itself.
Well, it's a big job, I will admit. It's a big job, and I just remind myself, just chip away. Because at the start of a novel, it's a big job. And if you try to get your head around how much work it's going to be and that it'll probably take that much time and energy to get it right, and even then when you've got it right, there'll still be tiny things you haven't got right, it's not possible to even do it. It'd be like trying to imagine climbing Everest. But if you just go, all I've got to do is one chip, everyone can do a chip. So even if you forward your thing a small chip, as long as you forward it every single day a chip, well, then you're all right, right?
Mm.
I hate the unknown. I hate that it might not work. I hate when it's all messy, and it's. I don't like the doubt. I don't like the doubt. Doubt, I don't like it.
Have you written novels that you've abandoned where it hasn't worked? You've got to a point where you've just thought, no, I can't make this work.
I guess not.
So everything that you've started, you've finished?
No. I mean, I can have, interestingly, I can have characters that emerged 20 years ago that I'm reconsidering now. And I can partially write something and then return to it, but I can't think of your great big works. So no, I think I trust my instincts enough to know. Yeah, I don't like the start, and I don't like doubting, and I don't like that might be the case. You know, I don't want to waste hundreds of thousands of words, and yeah. I guess we all have to, as writers, I just remind myself what I can trust. Well, do you have the inclination to do it? Okay. Break it down. Do you have the will to do it? This morning when you rise up, do you want to do it? Okay, you do. All right, well, let's just go with that. If that's all you've got to go on, then go with that. That tells you enough. But it was hard. Do you want to do it again? Okay, that was Monday. How do you feel Tuesday? Do you want to do it? I guess I do. Okay, well, that's all you've got to follow then. Just keep holding that rope. You know, that's all you've got to go on. And even if that whole first draft is crappy, but did you keep wanting to do it, okay, well, then that whole first draft, at the end of that, maybe 100,000 words, a character will emerge. Oh, I keep wanting to do that. Okay, well, keep. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, that's a great way to think about it.
Yeah, and then if you keep going, following that little thread of energy, it will hopefully, surely it's got to lead you to what does want to happen and what story does. That thread that is there that you want to reveal, right? Mm. Tell me that I'm on to. Have I got that right?
Because otherwise, I think you've got that right.
I can hope so. Because otherwise, you know, I'd be doing a lot of work for nothing.
Yeah. Now, we're here at the Headland Writers Festival at the moment, which we were just talking before we started about where the green room is and finding the green room. You must have been in lots of green rooms over the years.
Yeah.
What has been your strangest or most interesting experience in a green room?
I can't say they've been places of too much happening. I'm always, I'll have my journal out and be well on the way to the next destination. I haven't had the opportunity one way or another to sit about too much and enjoy them. For the Sydney Writers Festival, I didn't even make it to the green room before we were doing complex sound checks in those huge spaces. It would be fun. I remember being at, they're potentially very fun spaces, and you can see all sorts of people that, you know, have voices that we all hear, you know,
Okay, our last question that we ask everyone, what story do you hope your biographer will never uncover?
Golly. Oh, wow. Well, I wouldn't be uncovering it now.
Why not, Sophie? No, safe because, space. Safe space.
No, because everyone will hear the truth. you know, I write a lot of fiction and I never really speak too much. You know, a lot of writers really write about nonfiction about themselves a lot, about partners and heartbreak and miscarriage and terminations and divorces and moving house and birth and everything. I can't imagine that being, you know, really particularly comfortable. I've written a little bit for children about myself, but it doesn't feel like it wants to happen in that way. You know, I don't want to talk about, yeah, I have ordinary struggles like everyone else. I don't have never really had an inclination to write very personally in nonfiction. But see, it's my view that fiction, there is nothing more personal. And readers are blind not to know that. It is as personal and as in, it's like you've got the author's dreams in your hand. They're unconscious dreams in your hands. So that's about as intimate and as honest, if the fiction's good, really good, as it can get. It's far more, I think, far more revealing. But no one ever knows that, so perhaps best not to remind them. It's about as honest as it can get, I think.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Do you?
I do. I totally agree. I think fiction is actually the place to go and actually learn about the world and human beings and the way we all move in that space.
Yeah, it's a deeper truth, isn't it?
Absolutely.
It's the unspoken truth. It's the nuanced truth. This is good fiction. It's the shadowy, hard to pin down.
Yeah, all the truth. Complexity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And like dreams. Yeah, it's sort of like it doesn't necessarily spell anything out, because in life nothing really can be spelled out that's important.
Yeah, I love that. You have the author's dreams in your hands. Thank you, Sophie.
And their nightmares.
And well, that's true. That is also true.
Secrets from the Green Room was recorded on the lands of the Ngunnawal and Ngambri peoples, never ceded. If you've enjoyed this episode, please leave a review on iTunes, which helps others to find us.
And you can contact us via our website at secretsfromthegreenroom.com, where you'll also find links to us on all the socials, Twitter, Instagram and Facebook. Come join us.